Good evening. Good evening. And welcome. And thank you all for coming on this rather cold day. The Honour Frost Foundation has now been in existence for 6 years. And we've been busily funding different sorts of activities in Honour's chosen domains in the Eastern Mediterranean, with principal focus on Cyprus and Lebanon, and we're very much hoping to work in Syria before much too long. Most of the trustees were able to attend and thoroughly enjoy an amazing conference in Cyprus to celebrate Honour's 100th birthday. A beautiful cake in the shape of a stone anchor was cut. I think she would have been both amused and impressed. And what was amazing was that the turnout to this event was over 300 people from all over the world, an almost unprecedented attendance, I believe. And of the speakers, over 30% had been funded by the Honour Frost Foundation. And there was also a dazzling collection of posters created by maritime archaeology students from many places, which was so good and so impressive that the trustees have decided to award a special prize for the best one. This magical event was jointly organised by Dr. Lucy Blue and Dr. Stella Domestica of the University of Cyprus. I expect most of you, if not all of you, are aware that Lucy was appointed Maritime Archaeological Director of the Foundation in June 2016 to help the trustees with the development of their strategy and mastermind its fulfilment. And I'm delighted to ask you now to welcome her here so that she can tell you about what the Foundation's been doing and how she envisages the fulfilment of Honour's dream. Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you, everybody, for making the effort to get here. I know that some of you may have to leave early. It's horrible out there, so I do really appreciate you coming this evening. Now, I meant to get this out earlier. It's here, I know it's here. Oh, never mind. I have my kazoo. For those of you that came to the conference in Cyprus, you will know the kazoo. So if there's any misbehaving, I'll bring it out. I'm going to start with a quotation from Honour. And this I discovered when I was listening to John Carswell's lecture that he gave here 2 years ago. And it says, "Know where you're going before you start." And I think quite a lot of you in the room who know me well probably realise that that is a message that I should have taken on board some years ago. But I think with respect to Honour, it was definitely something that she took and believed in strongly from a very early age. And she certainly, within the vision of her career as a maritime archaeologist, and I believe strongly in the vision of this foundation, that she very much knew where she was going before she started. So, in that line, I'm going to tell you where I'm going within the context of this lecture. I'm basically going to give you a short review of Honour's life from a perspective that I think is important with respect to the work that she did and the character that she was, and then sort of think about that in the context of maritime archaeology today and how she was facing and we face different challenges, some similar challenges, in the context today, and then move on to the context of maritime archaeology with respect to the Honour Frost Foundation, the activities of the foundation, and where I hope that we will be moving going forward. So Honour, as a lot of you know, was born on the island of Cyprus in 1917. Regrettably, she was orphaned at a young age and was brought up by her guardian, Wilfred Evel, who was he was a society man, well positioned, and he also was a collector of fine arts, which was a critical thing for the creation of this foundation. She was she trained initially as an artist, as I'm sure a lot of you know, and she had a very illustrious career for over a decade as a designer for the ballet. And sometime after that, she decided to take a career change, and in the 1950s, she learned to dive, partly trained by Jacques Cousteau and Dumas, or Didi, as she referred to him, and she worked extensively with them over the next stage in her career. And this is basically the stage at which she embarked on a career in maritime archaeology, very much focused in the eastern Mediterranean, so basically going back to her roots, as Alison has explained. Anna was a formidable lady, I think, is a way to describe her. You'll look at some of the descriptions that Elpida Hadjijakis, who gave a lecture about Anna, amongst many others, in the footsteps of Anna session at the Cyprus conference. And these are some of the remarks she made about her character, her determination, her fearlessness. And I think those of you that knew her can relate to that. We're talking about a lady who would drive her Volkswagen Beetle from the UK to Syria in the 1960s all alone on numerous occasions. She wasn't going to be stopped. And I think probably the best thing to illustrate that resilience and determination is actually her first encounter with the underwater world. And this was when she dived in a well in Wimbledon on a very similarly cold and snowy evening. And I'm just going to read the section where she describes that experience in her book to you. Because I think it really sort of places her. There were 6 metres of black water above my head, and I sucked air through a mouthpiece, connected by a hose to a pump on the surface. Sometimes I forgot and breathed through my nose, which means drawing out the negligible quantity of air in my suit, as opposed to the supply in my mouth. A full moon above on the snow-covered garden, but I was no longer conscious of that world. And I think that really, for me, positions Anna in terms of her connection with this new world that she was discovering, whether it was in a dark well in Wimbledon and or what she was going to experience in the wonderful waters of the Mediterranean. This is the book that she wrote in 1963, which I'm sure you're aware of, that I've just quoted from. And as I've said, Anna said, my journey to the bottom of the well has now been continued to Mediterranean waters. I'm now going to reference back in terms of access to those Mediterranean waters. I think we need to contextualise the work that Anna was doing with respect to how critical it was in terms of the technology that was available. This is a quote probably from around the 1920s, basically indicating that the most rich museum in the world is that which is inaccessible, i.e. on the floors of the eastern Mediterranean. But by the time that Anna was working, SCUBA, the self-contained underwater breathing apparatus, I don't need to tell a lot of you that, was now available. And so those museum doors were starting to open. And Anna was one of those first people to access shipwrecks, amphora mounds, etc. So she was, as we know, at a critical point in these new discoveries in the context of maritime archaeology in the eastern Mediterranean and the Mediterranean more broadly. Anna then goes on to talk about the sites that she investigated in the book, and she talks about them in orders of complexity. So her first and probably her true love was anchors, stone anchors in particular. But she also did pioneering work in harbour archaeology. I'm actually very much a prodigy of her work. She inspired me to look into the harbours of the eastern Mediterranean in the late Bronze Age period, and I was very dependent upon her publications. But I think what was unique about her was the way she viewed these landscapes, and that she was able to sort of identify the significance of sea level change, the seamlessness, the fact that people were utilising harbours in these early periods, not just the monumental structures of the latter Greco-Roman periods. Now, she was also very involved with shipwreck archaeology. She was invited, as you probably know, to the first expedition of the Cape Caledonia shipwreck. Now, this is where my technological capabilities are going to be tested, because I'm going to do to play a short extract. Hang on, let's just stop that. Why didn't that come up then? Oh, we've been practicing this, I'm sorry. This is an extract from actually one of my students submitted about 10 years or so ago. I think this is the only time I've ever given anybody 100%. He managed to make a video around the Cape Caledonia, and this is a small section that I want to share with you, partly because George Bass is telling us about this early discovery, but also because I think it puts you in the context of the world in which Anna was working. Okay, yeah, that's good. Thanks.
In sailing down the coast, barely know the words of the shell, the crew of surface, sneaking down the engine room along on the stone ballast. There's no bathroom or anything else. It was a several day trip, but there were dolphins sometimes right ahead of us. And it was just the beginning of a huge adventure for 3 months. And we died once before and over more. So, everything was new, everything. The language, the living on a boat with very, very helpful people, the diving, it was just very new. We needed a spot of fresh water, and so we sailed along the coast, and a little cove with a narrow strip of beach. I noticed there were two dam patches in the sand. And so we had shovels, and so we dug them out, and nice little streams of fresh flowing water, which we dammed up, and that was the water we had all summer for eating, and for cooking, and drinking, and bathing, and also soaking the corrosive salts out the artifacts, especially the metal artifacts. So it was really the source of water that determined where we were, and that was about, I forgot whether it was half an hour or an hour sail away from the actual wreck site. And now, if we go back, which we hope to do for the 50th anniversary, we have fresh water beakers on our ship, and so we can put a camp right there on the little island that we're right to the flood.
And this apparently was the music they listened to when they were sailing to site every day, because obviously they were in the kaiki that they were living on. So you can see the context was really quite different. Yes. So this was not the only shipwreck excavation Honor was involved with. She was... it won't come up again. Oh, that's the blank one that we put to... Yeah, okay. she not only... if we could leave the lights. Yeah, thanks. So she in the early 1970s, she not only discovered, excavated... lifted, conserved, and eventually, after much struggle, should we say, managed to put on display the Punic ship wreck that I'm sure you're all very familiar with. But I just want to sort of end this bit about Honor thinking about the context, because at that period of time, she was one of very few pioneering maritime archaeologists at all, but certainly in the region, probably the only female one. So the numbers were small, the knowledge base was quite limited. And in terms of the legal and management context, we've been talking a bit about that today, we had no UNESCO convention. She actually was quite fundamental in the development of the Council of Nautical Archaeology and setting up the IJNA. So sort of our knowledge bases, our access to information was much more limited. And the rules and the legislation around protecting heritage was also very at a rudimentary level. We can also think about the levels of technology available at that time. So, so if we think about this picture in the middle is actually from Caledonia, and this is at the sort of point where scuba was being used. And nowadays, of course, we have technologies that we can get into suits that will take us down hundreds, if not thousands of metres to the seabed to actually access the material ourselves. So in terms of the visibility of maritime archaeology and the access for maritime archaeologists, things have changed tremendously in the last 50 years. As many of you know here, we are also able to locate, record sites both in deep waters and shallow waters with much more ease nowadays, thanks to the changes in remote, in the improvements in remote sensing. We can now get much deeper, thousands of meters under the water, with aspects of photogrammetry and lasers, etc. And I'll just show you. I'm sure a lot of you have seen this remarkable photograph of the 16th century vessel in the Baltic region, I have to say. So the preservation, don't get too excited. It's not like that, as we know, in the Mediterranean. But these sorts of vessels can be recorded using laser scanners and photogrammetry. This is some of the work of my colleague John Adams from the Black Sea Project, looking at shipwrecks. They've discovered over 60 shipwrecks where they are literally recording vessels at 90 to 100, 200 metres of depth in maybe an hour time, you know, 40 metres long with photogrammetry and laser scanners, etc. So our ability to locate, record and digitise information is so much greater than it was when ONA was starting. So we have these tools of technology that are aids to the improvement of our vision of shipwrecks. So now we can put virtual reality glasses on and record these 3D printed models in the leisure of our own homes. But the context of the actual the nature of maritime resource, or the coastal heritage resource, particularly on the coastline, as we were talking about earlier today, is very much under threat, probably much more so than it was at the time when ONA first started working. And certainly in the region of the Eastern Mediterranean, there are big issues to do with looting in particular, and possibly the largest threat is that of coastal development. When ONA first went to Bodrum in the late 1950s, she approached a village full of 200 fishermen on a dirt track. Now this is a tourist resort with over 40,000 people. The images here show you pictures of Beirut in the 1900s, and if any of you have been there recently, you'll know how incredibly fast that urban expansion has happened, particularly in the post-conflict period. So the challenges that we face in terms of identifying, recording, and preserving, in some cases, the coastal and underwater archaeology are quite enormous, particularly in the region that the focus of that the foundation focuses in. And in addition to that, other challenges that the foundation faces, and in general we face in terms of developing areas of maritime archaeology are to do with the limited resources available. So, for example, in our region, there are only a handful of people who actually are professional maritime archaeologists. There's certainly no context within the legislation or management, or certainly the management, to protect the maritime archaeological resource. There are no maritime conservation specialists, certainly in Lebanon and Cyprus. And so it goes on. And I want to look into that in a bit more detail in a minute. But the other thing that's important to recognise is that whilst we have a lack of resources, both in terms of the infrastructure and the personnel, there's also quite often a lack of visibility. There's a lack of understanding and appreciation of maritime heritage, and that different political perspectives and individual perspectives don't necessarily see the archaeology, if you see what I mean. So like the Amtali Gormley photo art installation, rather, where he's looking into from the shores to the sea, there isn't a visibility of what's under that water. And I think quite often maritime and coastal heritage is not visible in the political view. And quite often what I say when I'm giving lectures to other audiences, we need a Mary Rose moment. We need the point at which the ship comes out of the water and is installed in a museum, because that's the point quite often when the political and individual and social consciousness realises the value of some of these shipwrecks. So one of the other challenges is beyond the coastal development and the lack of resource is to actually demonstrate the value of the heritage and change perspectives. This is, a very long quote, but I was delighted to find it, actually, when I was reading through the reports. I'll talk a bit about this in a minute. We ran a field school in Lebanon in October in 2017, and we asked the students, this was a training, we taught some of them to dive, the archaeological students to dive, and then they did the NASH training course, and we asked them to write reports. So these were unsolicited reports, and this is one of a section from one of the reports that was written by a student who's studying archaeology, I think at master's level at the American University of Beirut. So he's early in his career, but he was able to identify all of these things, that maritime archaeology has not received much support, there's much work to be done, it's hampered by lack of government funding, there's abundance of looting, chaotic urbanisation, buildings of beach resorts all along the Lebanese coast, and at the same time we have this lacuna in professional maritime archaeologists, not enough work being done, and it's not being taught in universities. So I think this very nicely actually represents for me the challenges that we face in the context of working in the region, perhaps more so in Lebanon and certainly in Syria at this point, but even to a certain extent in Cyprus. So this is not an unusual challenge. As many of you know, I have, and along with other colleagues in the audience, such as Colin Breen, have been working in the area of trying to, what we call, develop capacity. Capacity is a term defined by various international organisations, but it's not necessarily been addressed until perhaps the last few years in the context of maritime and coastal heritage. And so a number of us have been doing a lot of work over the last 10 years, in the Eastern Mediterranean, in Africa, and in the Arabian Gulf, in my particular case, trying to build capacity, raise awareness in terms of trying to resource and protect the coastal maritime resource. And so there are various stages in trying to address this, to do with identification and quantification. The people who manage these resources need to know they exist and they need to know what they look like. They need to know the context in which, the legislative context in which the resources is protected. And it's important that we work with the managers and also with the developers. That's something else we were talking about earlier, in terms of trying to address and raise awareness of what's there, to collate. We're working on a project, which I'll talk about a bit later, to actually map coastlines of this region so that we at least know what the resource looks like, and then work out management plans to support them going forward. Another important aspect of this is education, and Ona believed very strongly, as Alpida reminded us, in supporting the younger generation, and that's in order to develop their research skills, but also because they are our resource of the future. And in this region, as I've indicated, there is very little formalised education for maritime archaeology. I know in Egypt there is now, but certainly limited in Cyprus and nothing in Lebanon or Syria. And so you can approach this in different ways through universities and maritime centres. And in the past, I've helped set up, and we have some products of that institution sitting here, the Centre of Alexandria in the University of Alexandria in Egypt, which has now been going for 10 years, which is and successfully churning out some excellent students. You can do this through research projects. I was commissioned, along with colleagues from the Western Australia Museum, to spend a year identifying the resource along the Oman coast, training up the Omani Ministry of Culture representatives, and doing research to enhance their understanding of the coastal resource. So there are precedents for this, as well as communicating through workshops, field schools, the NAS training program. This is a workshop that we ran, 2010 now, many years ago, as a product of a conference that we... So this is one of the first workshops, I think, in maritime archaeology in Egypt. Establishing collaborative research frameworks, raising awareness and changing the cultural perspectives. And I'll just put a little bit of a plug in here for our colleague. So it's about trying to identify value and placing raising awareness of the resource. Okay, so now I'll move on to the story of the foundation. The foundation, as I'm sure a lot of you know, was founded in 2011. And here is Honor sitting in her dining room, actually below one of the paintings that basically formed the basis for the legacy, for the endowment that set up the foundation. She was very clear in her will, which I'll show you a section of in a minute, what she wanted this money to be spent on, and who she wanted to manage the resource. And many of the trustees are sitting here today. We have other employees, myself and Neelam and Rebecca, who help behind the scenes. And also she was very clear about the geographical remit that the foundation should address. That was Honor's map, actually. So this is a section from her will that basically makes it very clear that she wanted to promote the advancement of research, including publications in the region, and these are the sorts of things that she wanted to support in terms of research, museums, galleries, excavations, students, training, etc. So these are the five main areas that the foundation has chosen to focus on, very much in line with the will that Honor left. And this is the system. I hope, as you know, my technical abilities aren't the greatest, but this is that basically maps out the system that the granting process is contained within. So the countries, the geographical remit has been debated extensively, but is essentially the Eastern Mediterranean, focusing in on largely Syria, Lebanon, and Cyprus, but also Egypt and Turkey, Israel, but also Sicily and Malta because she worked in those areas. We have small grants, and we do offer larger grants, although not through an official granting system. And these are essentially the areas that we are interested in building funding possibilities for, but also building capacity in. Largely, the granting system focuses around research and developing the discipline. In the early years, the focus was on small grants. This was a stage when I think everybody was beginning to sort of getting to grips with what the nature of the resource was about, what's maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean, who are the players, and how do we best spend our money. We invested in some larger projects, such as the CNRS remote sensing project off the Lebanon coast, and we set up bursaries for students, initially through the University of Southampton, but now that's extended to other universities. We engaged with the Nautical Archaeology Society to start the training program in Cyprus. We supported exhibitions, this is the one in the Ashmolean, and we started on a conservation program with the Kyrenia shipwreck people. But I think most importantly at that stage, under the guidance of my colleagues sitting over there, we engaged in dialogue and building collaborative networks. And I think this is critical to the way that the foundation has moved forward, because that dialogue is the only way we can really understand what it is that people in the region want from the support that the foundation can offer. So just to briefly go through, I'm going to sort of start on a broad base and hone in to give you some examples of some of the work that we've been supporting more recently. All the images presented, I'm sorry they haven't all got, they're not all noted as to who provided them, but they're all products of Honor Frost Foundation funded work. So we're focusing on research. That's one of the primary drivers, is to develop knowledge of the region through coastal and underwater survey and excavation, and through a range of different approaches that maritime archaeologists, such as ethnography and oral history. We're also interested in developing the discipline, and I will look in a bit more detail as to some of the things, but particularly aspects of technology that allow us to further identify, map, and record the archaeology in the area. But also this has implication, of course, for the extension of our knowledge base and our resource base and our technical base for maritime archaeology more widely. Education and training are at the core of the Honour for Us Foundation's objectives. So, as I've said, we support scholarships to master's, doctoral and postdoctoral level in those institutions. Now we've extended bursaries. I know a number of people here have also been recipients of bursaries to attend conferences and workshops. And we have engaged with the Nautical Archaeology Society and deliver training and dive training as well, because a lot of the students in these regions are keen archaeologists, but they are not divers. So the first thing is we need to be able to resource them to be able to dive. Other capacity building, resource building projects, a very key one actually that we were discussing in a meeting earlier today is the Syria benchmarking project. This is one we hope of many that the Foundation has commissioned in order to identify the resource in the coastal zone and underwater, nearshore underwater zone of Syria, in advance of hopefully a peaceful resolution to the conflict at the moment, so that we have a resource that can be a useful tool, in effect. We know where the archaeology is, we know what the threats are, both natural and human-based. And so that's a big aspect of the Foundation's objectives, is to map the region so that we have an idea of the nature of the resource before we make decisions, obviously along with dialogue with those working in the region as to where the priorities lie. We have set up the Honour for Us Foundation Steering Committee, which works on aspects of legislation in the UK and beyond. And we support the Department of Antiquities in Cyprus, their conservation laboratories and conservation projects to do with the Kyrenia. And we're also very interested in communicating what the Foundation does to a range of different people. So we've supported conferences, as Alison mentioned earlier, and museum exhibitions. We run lecture tours, including this one, mostly in the region, so that we raise awareness with students of archaeology to actually become more in tune with the fact that they, as archaeologists, can actually do coastal and underwater work. We supported the Maritime Archaeological Trust outreach bus, which was a huge success this summer in Cyprus, visiting schools and public areas and telling people about maritime archaeology. They had it in both languages so that they could engage with the archaeology in the region in their own language. And we support a series of publications, including this volume here, which was published by my colleague Imad Khalil. So it's a reader of maritime archaeology in Arabic. This is the first time that it's accessible in terms of learning about maritime archaeology in a language that hasn't, you know, that in regional language. And here we have the product of the Honour for Us conference that Alison mentioned earlier. And I think what really strikes me here is not just the number of people that attended. This is in the legacy of the Tropis series, which some of you may have attended, but the numbers were certainly smaller. But it's certainly a reflection of the way that maritime archaeology has grown in the last few decades, not just in terms of the number of players, but also in terms of the nature of the material that we're looking at. So we're not just looking at shipwrecks, we're not just looking at harbours, we're now interested in management and ethnography and cultural landscapes, etc. So, and I think that represents a much more truly interdisciplinary approach to the way that we view those coastal landscapes, a much more seamless way of seeing the world. Now, I'm beginning to think that I've got too many lists, but anyway, I'll try and not read you through all of them. So I just wanted to sort of focus in a little bit on some of the projects, specific projects that we're doing in the key countries, Lebanon and Cyprus. So one of the big projects we support is the work at Byblos. Byblos was, I think, probably one of Honor's favourite sites. She worked for many years there before and after the revolution, the Civil War, sorry. And she, I think she really saw that as her home. And so we've supported at least, I think, getting on for 9 seasons now of work there, looking for the Bronze Age harbour that was always Honor's key, you know, the thing she always wanted to find. But in addition to that, we've been doing quite a lot of coastal survey, coastal mapping, particularly around key harbour sites, so Tyre, Sidon, Byblos as well, working with the University of Patras and the CNRS in Lebanon. And then in addition to that, we've funded quite a lot of small-scale projects. effects. Initially, these were very much products of reactions to applications made through the small granting process. But more recently, I think we're focusing in trying to be more proactive in the way that we think about those sites as a result of things like Lucy Saman's desk-based assessment that are potentially more under threat from coastal development or have more potential to tell us about the archaeology of the region. So the Tyre Harbour Survey, for example, and the work that's being done in Batroun and Sidon. We work very closely with the University of Balamam. We support Lucy Saman. She is the first Doctor of Maritime Archaeology that has been a product of Lebanon, and we're supporting her through a three-year postdoc. And this is basically looking at the maritime cultural landscape of a site to the north. You can see on the bottom right here, Amphae. She produced a desk-based assessment, which we hope to build on to understand the resource of the coast of Lebanon, coastal Lebanon. And she was, along with other colleagues, were very fundamental in supporting these initial dive and NAS training projects that we ran. And this was as a result of a series of lectures that Lucy and I gave earlier this year in Lebanon to the key universities, to the universities of Lebanon in their different bases and also AUB, and realising that because there is no resource to teach maritime archaeology in Lebanon at the moment, that we could provide other opportunities through teaching them to dive and putting them through NAS training courses and hopefully then targeting them towards research projects that the foundation are funding. So it's about trying to build that expert base in country. We support a number of doctoral and MA students, mostly based at the University of Southampton. Some of them are here. So this is also about educating on many levels. I think the key with education is realising who it is you're trying to educate and what messages you're trying to get across, and making sure that the educational processes are appropriate to the needs. So we're hitting education and training on many different levels. In Cyprus, again, we work very closely with the University of Cyprus. In Cyprus, the situation is a little bit different. Stella Domestica, who you may have seen speaking here a couple of years ago, is a very active maritime archaeologist working on the Mazotos shipwreck primarily. And so she already offers some training through a master's program in maritime archaeology in Cyprus. So we work very closely with her, but also support a number of projects of a variety of nature, some to do with mapping using AUVAs, some to do with harbour sites, some to do with coastal surveys. These are largely through the small grant scheme. And as I already mentioned, working with the Kyrenia Conservation of the Finds, which has recently come to an end. We work very closely with the Department of Antiquities as well. We're building up a good relationship with them. We support their conservation labs, and we are starting to run a series of workshops to engage their conservators, who are not necessarily trained maritime archaeological conservators, but we hope to run workshops with a number of conservators in the region so that we can start raising the conservators' awareness of working with different materials, waterlogged wood and metals that have been recovered from underwater. And we also support scholarships within the University of Cyprus, so there are students going through at MA level that are being supported through the foundation. Our work in Syria, regrettably, as you can probably appreciate, is not quite so extensive considering the current political situation. But as I mentioned, we have supported this benchmarking project, which is about another 2 months to run and is really building on our understanding of the nature of the coastal resource, but also the threats, both in terms of urban expansion, coastal erosion, infrastructure expansion, etc. And this we are in the process of integrating into the EMENA, with the Endangered Archaeology in the MENA region database. So this should become a resource that is actually publicly accessible in a short period of time. I'll mention briefly our work in Egypt. A number of the students are here. One of the main projects we support, besides the Naukratis project from the British Museum, is also the Centre of Maritime Archaeology Alexandria Mersa Baghouz project, as well as the Greek mission. One of the big projects that we support, though, is the French Centre in Alexandria. We support both their field work, but also their publication series. So I hope you're getting a sense of the scale of the different things that the Foundation are currently engaged with. As I said, we've sort of focused on an aspect of small grant support, which is around developing the discipline. So it means that we can give grants to people that aren't necessarily working specifically in the Eastern Mediterranean, but are interested in developing technologies or investigative processes, or specific things such as anchors, such that were on us great love, so that there are opportunities to support things outside of the specific geographical region of the Eastern Mediterranean. This extends to support for UNESCO meetings, but also our British Academy, HFF grants, etc. Ona Frost left a very extensive archive. She, as I said at the beginning, certainly knew she was planning. And she was incredibly detailed in the work she did. She kept copies of everything. And over the last few years, we have been cataloguing the archive with a number of people, ending up with Emma Saunders. And after long discussions with numerous institutions, I can very pleased to announce that eventually the University of Southampton Special Collection, and this is not a biased, I hasten to add, they have literally changed their special collections policy in order to take, not only to take on the Ona Frost Foundation archive, but to build on it as well. So for all of those people who have archives or know of others who have helped form the discipline, I'm hoping that the Ona Frost archive will be the first, will be the trigger to focus maritime archaeological archives at the University of Southampton. We run a number of other projects. One is the Soundings Project, which is basically a series of interview projects discussing with people who worked with Ona or were fundamental in developing the field about their experiences and what we can, the sort of history of the discipline, as is the Writing Ona Project, which is essentially a vehicle of trying to use Ona as a lens to see how the discipline developed in the region and beyond. I've mentioned already the NAS training program. We've done 3 years of training in Cyprus, and we just started NAS training very specifically, less field school-based, but training-based in Lebanon. And here are some images and also some quotes from the students, which have been hugely helpful in us understanding how valuable these things are to them. Another project that is in the making, should I say, we had a workshop in Akrotiri, which is, this is the south central coast of Cyprus. One of the things that we're keen to do is develop larger scale projects. So most of the projects we've funded to date, with a few exceptions, have basically been around, you know, the £10,000 small grant projects. But we are keen to look towards trying to develop projects that are of a larger scale, that have more impact, that engage a number of different scholars. So the principle behind this project, which would look at the maritime cultural landscape of southern Cyprus, would be to work with extant scholars, to look from the Paleolithic through to the modern day, to look at landscape change. It's a region where there's some quite pristine landscapes in the sort of Akrotiri area here because of the base, the UK base, but also areas where there's been massive development, such as along here. So it gives us the opportunity to try and build up a resource, to train students, and to actually start looking at a landscape and how that changed over time, because most of the work that's happened on the island to date has been quite myopic and site-specific in its focus. So that's an aspiration that I'm building at the moment. Another, I think, very successful approach to trying to understand and protect to a certain extent the resource is the smaller scale coastal surveys, but using very much an interdisciplinary approach. So this is a project that is based out of the University of Lebanon in Sidon, and over the summer, in conjunction with colleagues, in fact, Nicolas Carillon, who's here, who's a geomorphologist, archaeologist, so he's looking for coastal sea level indicators. We've done coastal survey in a region that we thought, this is north of Tyre and south of Beirut in a general sense, we thought would be fairly pristine. But in fact, you can see this extensive amount of agriculture and roads to access the agriculture, which are dug through quite substantial archaeology in this case. So I think the challenges are not just to do with this urban expansion, but also to do with the agricultural expansion. And we need, and I'm hoping to sort of encourage more projects of this nature, because we need to have an understanding of what the resource is and work out ways of recording it and, in certain cases, protecting it. So this means working alongside with the archaeologists, but also the heritage managers. So I'm hoping to scale up these sorts of projects going forward. So the principles behind this, I hope the trustees are going to agree with this slide. I should have circulated it in advance. I think, personally, it's critical that we have dialogue. Dialogue is the only way that we can understand what it is that we can do to help develop in the region and where the key priorities lie. I think we also need to be aware that we want to avoid sort of imposing our will on the region, because that was certainly not the way that Honor worked, and it was certainly not what we want as the legacy for the foundation. So we need to be aware of this sort of benevolent stance, as it were. And I think that when the foundation first started, it was a question of, you know, what's out there? What is the nature of the field, and who are the players? But now, particularly, I have, you know, all of the trustees came to the foundation conference and sat through all of the lectures, which I was hugely impressed with, because now I think everybody has a much clearer idea of what we can do and the scale of the challenge ahead, but also how incredibly lucky we are that Honor has left this amazing resource that we can actually do something. So I would say that our approach now is becoming more proactive rather than reactive. And that last one's for Roger, because I'm working within the million a year, I promise. These are some of the statistics. It's not my forte, but I just thought, you know, let's have a look at the number of grants that we've awarded. Some nearly 100, but not quite, I think. Research grants, scholarships, and the bursaries. So we are doing lots of things. We are, you know, supporting students and research on many different countries and in many different types of projects. So in terms of where we would like to go with this, obviously research is critical to the focus of the foundation, and we will certainly continue to support the small grant research-led projects, but we also like to think about developing a higher profile project, something that has impact across the region. I'm hoping that this Maritime Cultural Landscape project would be the first of maybe a number of research projects that are engaging, interdisciplinary, and they're engaging a number of scholars. It's like an umbrella project in a way, but it also facilitates training. I think it's most important. People are key to the success of the foundation's work, and it's most important that we identify those people and we train the students and we resource and make sure that people have the right expertise and the right technical skills. So that means education on many levels, from academic university basis down to dive training, short FAC courses. There are some very real, as I've exemplified, challenges in the region, and I think that we need to hone in on addressing those challenges, particularly where there is rapid coastal development. We need to expand our baseline knowledge of what archaeology is there, both on shore and underwater, and make sure that those data sets are communicated with the managers in the region through dialogue, targeting exactly how best to manage and protect the resource. We need to build and expand the local infrastructure and promote more widely the work that we're doing, not so much for the foundation, but for the importance of maritime archaeology more broadly, so that maritime archaeology and coastal heritage in the region has a profile. And that can only happen through continued collaboration and working towards sustainable platforms. So specifically in the region, we have been in dialogue more extensively recently with the ministry responsible, with the department, the DGA, about particular things that they need, about building and understanding the resource, about developing the benchmarking project, extending their GIS, thinking about integrated coastal management, thinking about building a team of people potentially to help survey and respond to development of marinas and offshore infrastructure, because currently there is nobody, with the exception of Lucy Saman and one or two divers, who there's no maritime archaeological team within the department. So in a way, it's up to us to help them develop that resource, because this development is happening so rapidly that it needs to have happened yesterday, really. And then in conjunction with that, targeting certain areas which we think are going to be the next targets, in a way. So we are in discussion in the region of Tyre and in other places to try and do more comprehensive mapping, understanding of how the coastline has changed, how the harbours have changed, how people occupied those landscapes, so that we understand those landscapes before they are developed. And more of the El Caribe type projects, where we're looking at these interdisciplinary coastal surveys. So again, it's about recording the resource in advance of development. And then obviously also training both students and government employees, and potentially developing the infrastructure for education systems within the country. And this can happen in different ways, whether it's at MA level or minor programs or standalone modules. Even the lectures that Lucy and I have been doing have been informative, and we need to build on this sort of resource so that eventually there is the expertise in-house to deliver the education in maritime archaeology that will train the maritime archaeologists of the future. In Cyprus, whilst their understanding of the resource is greater, there's still a need to build on that. Again, they have no maritime experts within the Department of Antiquities. Their GIS is limited, should we say, and they are very much in need of more support to develop an understanding of the coastal resource in its hilarity. We've been talking about trying to work more closely with them, also to develop a team that could focus in on surveying areas that are either more under threat or yet to be, you know, the more pristine areas, so enhancing and understanding the resource. I've already mentioned this idea of a larger scale, multidisciplinary, what I call umbrella, because it's engaging a number of scholars, both Cypriot and foreign, international scholars who are already working in this region and building on their understanding of landscape, but introducing this maritime dimension so that we start to understand how that landscape changed over time and space. And then a series of workshops engaging conservation. So at least we're building up a skill base in Cyprus for dissemination in the region more broadly. In the longer term, well, I mean, I think it's a continuity of dialogue and education and survey. We could look towards some higher profile research projects. We've definitely got a view to try and develop some form of publication capacity for the foundation. I think it's important that we make the products of the research that we do accessible to as many people as possible, hopefully avoiding any sort of payment, so an online publication resource, and maybe in the future more high-profile projects that actually look towards disseminating the research that we do. We've been thinking of maybe making short videos around some of the projects that we're currently funding, perhaps doing tours. The bus example was a very successful one. Maybe we could expand on that, because I think we need to be hitting this on all levels. We need to be supporting students, we need to be working with governments, we need to be raising awareness within the broader populace, so that maritime archaeology and the importance and value of whatever view you take on it of the coastal heritage is something that you want to be part of and engaged with. So I'm ending. I'm just going back to Honor's quote. I actually think that Honor was very, very clear about where she was going when she started the concept of this foundation. I think she was very clear about what she wanted it to do, and I think she was very clear about who she wanted to be involved with this, because I think that all of that in my mind makes sense in understanding how best to deliver what she saw was an incredible opportunity and a vision to expand our understanding of what I believe is now maybe the museum doors are fully open in terms of technology and our understanding in terms of accessing the depths of the Eastern Mediterranean. It's increasingly accessible. And I think that we have a lot to thank the Grande Dame of Archaeologie Sous-Marine, as Luciane, one of her very best friends, or very good friends, and described her as, in part for allowing us to understand and discover and giving us this amazing opportunity to develop maritime archaeology, not only in the region, but also, I think, as a platform for its understanding in the rest of the world. So thank you to the Foundation, and thank you mostly to Honor. Thank you. And thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a wonderful... wonderful talk, a great exploration of what we've been doing, and I couldn't have enjoyed it more. Thank you. Would you take any questions if anyone had any? Does anyone have any questions? Or is it time for a drink? There's one here.
Hi. Yeah, my name is Jana. I'm a journalist, and I was just wondering if the conference papers are going to be available, if they're going to be published, and
yes,
hopefully when would be the
well, yes,
question.
It's our intention to publish. Obviously, we've got some different ideas. There was a session called "In the Footsteps of Honor" that you may or may not be aware of that we hope to publish as a standalone. The other sessions, particularly around shipwrecks and ships and harbours and landscapes, we're hoping to ask for submission to peer review, so it's not just going to be a normal conference proceeding. And then we may have a function for like online reporting sort of system, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 words for those sort of papers that were very much part of a sort of, you know, a bigger project going forward. So it's taking a while because it's sort of locked in with some other things that we're doing as part of the Foundation's development. But it is our intention to publish, but maybe not in the more traditional conference proceedings way, because we realise that, you know, they need ref-returnable papers nowadays, not just something that's put in for a conference proceeding. So, but yes, but it may not happen. It'll hopefully happen this next year. Well, it will happen this next year. Anybody else? No?
Anyone else?
Oh, Bob.
Thank you.
Mine is not a question, it's really more a comment. As somebody who knew Honor very well and worked with her, I think she'd be hugely impressed with what the Foundation is doing and the opportunities it's giving to a huge number of people. Funds are very, very, very scarce in maritime archaeology, and this is sort of really beyond people's wildest dreams. So keep going. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Bob. Any more for any more? I'm going to have to get the kazoo out and wake you all up. Okay.
Very good.
All right. Thanks. And
thank you very much, Lucy. No. It's really been fantastic. And we'd like to invite you all to have a drink with us next door. Well done, that's true.